Welcome to the second of a three-part series entitled Priests, Wise Men, and Prophets, Another Look at the Hebrew Scriptures. Yesterday I introduced the series. I outlined for you the approach which I would like to follow, which is neither a historical one, which is perfectly all right in itself, nor a literary one, which is also very acceptable, but one that you might call a more sociologically oriented one. Not much depends, of course, on this term. We took our clue from the passage in Jeremiah 18:18, where we read in an aside that Israelite society of the time of Jeremiah, say approximately 600 BCE, had three leading offices or function: that of the priest, that of the wise man, and that of the prophet. And we also learned there through what media, through what instruments they exercised their function. The priest through instruction, the wise man or the elder through counsel or advice, and the prophet through the word of the Lord. Now, for review purposes, I have put this onto the blackboard again, and I suggested that this threefold division be the outline for this three-part series on another look at the Old Testament. Then I use the rest of the period to discuss with you the first of the three, namely the priestly office and how the priest, through instruction, exercises his function. That's fine, just pull it over a little bit, maybe we're in business. Fine, to complete my review of what I did yesterday, I worked with you on a passage in the second chapter of the book of Haggai, where the prophet uses an illustration that is taken from the work of the priest in order to drive home a point. Now, we were not interested in the particular point which the prophet Haggai wanted to drive home. That, of course, stands in its own right, rather in the illustration he used. And we learned there that of old priests in Israel, and that's, by the way, true also of the neighboring nations, were those who gave instruction in ritual matters, highly detailed, very fine points, certainly quite remote from our world and time, but understandable just the same. And then by way of conclusion, I outlined for you how this notion of priestly instruction, the Hebrew word is Torah, and later translated into the English word law with a capital L, how this notion of priestly instruction became ever more comprehensive until, in the time of Deuteronomy and later, and certainly by the time of the New Testament and the early rabbis, it was a very comprehensive term that meant as much as the codification of God's will for his people. It was much more a statement than a demand, much more a promise, an affirmation, than an order. And so I indicated at the very end that it could be compared much more to the Christian understanding of gospel than law. But you know how these terms sometimes change. By way of conclusion, let me read two passages from the book of Deuteronomy that show you this wider, comprehensive understanding of the word law, which of course is at home with the priests. In the fourth chapter, verses 7 and 8, "For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us whenever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that has statutes and ordinances so righteous," now listen, "as all this law which I set before you this day?" See the comprehensive quality of the notion of law here. And from the same biblical book, the 30th chapter, a section that could almost be read as a continuation of the passage I have just read. For this commandment, which I command you this day, is not too hard for you, neither is it far off. It is not in heaven that you should say, who will go up for us to heaven and bring it to us, that we may hear it and do it. Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will go over the sea for us and bring it to us, that we may hear it and do it. But the word, the law, is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart, so that you can do it. Now, so much by way of summary of my presentation yesterday. Today I would like to discuss with you the second of these functions, namely the work of the wise man or of the sage, or you could almost say of the simple philosopher. When you enter the world of the wise man, of the sage, you enter a different world, in comparison certainly to the world of the priests. The priests were eminently concerned with ritual. The wise men, while they mention that sphere and occasionally refer to it, are not primarily concerned with that at all. The priests are eminently concerned with what has been handed down from the past. The wise men have a much wider horizon in this respect. They are concerned not only with what is handed down from the past, they are certainly concerned with that too, but they are equally concerned with what is human here and now, on the individual plane, on the social plane, on the cultural plane, on the religious plane. The wise men are also concerned with the future, with the outcome of what a human being or a human society or a religious community now does. More, the priests are eminently concerned with Israel, with this religious community. So they mention much the name Israel, or the sons of Jacob, or Moses, or Aaron. The wise men are much more universal in their outlook. They do not mention the names Israel all that much. They do mention them. They have nothing against it. But their outlook is a much wider one. Their outlook, in fact, is cosmopolitan and international. Now, the Old Testament points that out to us very clearly. When it, for instance, says that the wisdom of Solomon, the patron saint, the fountainhead of wisdom in ancient Israel, was greater than all the wisdom of the ancients, greater than all the wisdom of the sons of the East. These were evidently legendary wise men already then, against which the Israelite scribe compares the wisdom of Solomon. So you see, the Old Testament is very much aware of the international, the cosmopolitan, the universal horizon of the wise man, of the budding philosopher. Now, when you ask, where in the Old Testament do we find the wise men at work? Where have they left for us what they said and thought and how they reflected and how they spoke and wrote? The obvious answer is, we turn to the book of Proverbs. That's not the only answer, but that is the first answer. And indeed, generally, in the Old Testament, the book of Proverbs is considered to be the most typical book of the wise men. It is attributed to Solomon, the fountainhead, the patron saint of wisdom in ancient Israel, just like the Psalter is attributed to David, the patron saint of all the singers in Israel. Now, in the book of Proverbs, of course, you find a good many things. Let me just give you a few samples so that you get a feel for what counsel, advice was, at least as far as the book of Proverbs is concerned. Now, there is so much in the book of Proverbs that one has to select, of course. There's much repetition there, too. Why not? Note a few things. The wise man began by formulating very short, pithy sayings. And they would like to see, even in the words that they use, some pointer to what they have to say. So they love alliteration. They love the rhyme of words. In fact, they can even suggest, they do not say that directly, but we can read that off their work, that there is a correspondence between the sound of words and things and to what they point. Listen to this. It's Hebrew, just four words, but I think you will catch it. Ba-zadon ba-kalon. Again. Ba-zadon ba-kalon. Now, Evelyn, these are two lines, aren't they? And you have a rhythm there. A-a-o, a-a-o. Now, when I translate it, it runs like this. When there comes arrogance, there comes shame. Now, we have similar proverbs in English and in German and in Greek that indicate that hubris, a human being forgetting his or her measure, will very quickly end up in shame, forgetting the right measure of things. That is the equivalent in Hebrew. It's a very old formulation, and the assonance, ba-zadon, ba-kalon, was one of their tools of formulating it. See how readily it is remembered? You can almost repeat it now. Or, let me give you another example. One of the earliest ways that we observe in the history of culture, of civilization, for people to make sense of themselves and of the world in which they live, is to ask, can we discern some order in it? Can we say what we know for sure? And can we say also what we not yet know for sure? Well, I think our civilization is still in that stage. One of the earliest forms of finding and formulating an order was to use a numerical element. You know how the earliest Greek philosophers asked, what is that which holds it all together? What are the elements out of which everything is made that we see? And no one will deny that the many things we see and experience and encounter can be very baffling and confusing indeed. What is it that holds it all together? And you remember how some of the early Greek philosophers, even before Socrates and Plato, said, there are four elements in this world that hold it all together. Or another one said, no, there is only one element, and that element is internal change. Or another one said, there is only one element, but it is very abstract. It is the infinite. Look what sort of reflection goes into that quest for finding an order in this world. By the way, the earliest Indian philosophers did the same thing. They also used the numerical element in order to detect and then formulate orders in this world. And you know what? We observe the same thing in ancient Israel. We have tucked away in a corner of the Old Testament, in the 30th chapter of the book of Proverbs, the quaint numerical sayings, where you also have this numerical element used. There are four that are small, yet exceedingly clever. And then you have four tiny animals listed that, while even though they are small, are very able to look after themselves. The ants is one group, you see. Or another numerical saying says there are three that the world cannot endure, four under which it simply cannot stand up. And then it lists four situations in which persons who really should not be the leaders turn things upside down and become the leaders. A slave when he becomes a master, a mistress, a second wife when she replaces the first wife, and so on and so on. Now, I could go on and give you many more examples. In fact, I invite you to go through the wisdom literature, especially the book of Proverbs, and find such examples yourself. And you will find a lot. Let me give you a few other ones to round out the picture a little bit. Humor was one of the means, the tools of the wise men to highlight their insight. Listen to this. A golden ring in the snout of the swine is a beautiful woman without discretion. Yeah. Well, listen to this one. Like the crackling of thorns under the cook pot is the laughter of the fool. You know, the fool laughs very loudly, but there's really nothing to it. It comes to nothing. Just like the crackling of thorns, that means of dry shrubbery that's used for fuel, you see. it comes to nothing. Or listen to this one. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he thinks he is smarter than you. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you become like him. Well, now, friends, what are you supposed to do? No matter what you do it wrong. Well, or rather, I should say, what you have here is a very early example of what in philosophy we call dialectic. That you cannot catch something by making a simple affirmative statement. That its opposite is equally true, and that you have to acknowledge both as equally true. Which very much highlights the ambiguity of human life in which we find ourselves. And the dialectic principle, as I'm sure many of you know, has been an agonizing one in the history of thought and the history of religion all through the ages. We encounter it in other places in the Bible, in the New Testament. We encounter it in our great philosophers and our great theologians, even the contemporary ones. Now, I could give you many more examples, but let these suffice as examples of individual counsels, advice that the wise man gives. Step two, we have to move further. This is not the only thing we have preserved in the Hebrew scriptures from the wise men. It goes way beyond this. The wise men, of course, were those who wanted to see things in their wider contexts and who were not afraid to tackle some of the very basic issues of human life. They began doing this in the Proverbs I have just quoted to you, but they moved much further. Let me only refer you to two outstanding examples. One is the book of Job. And in the book of Job, wise men in ancient Israel tried to tackle the question of what we classically say, the suffering of the righteous. A question with which anyone who is engaged in pastoral care has to deal. Any thoughtful human being, I'm sure, has to deal with it in relation to him or herself. And the whole book of Job, which of course we cannot discuss now, is the outcome of such sustained reflection of the wise men of ancient Israel on that very agonizing and ever-present issue in human life. Or let me give you another example. Many students of the Old Testament think that the first chapters in the book of Genesis, to be precise, most of the material we find in chapters 2 and 3 and 4 and 5, 6, 7, 8 and 10 and 11, that most of these materials come from wise men in ancient Israel, maybe connected with the royal court. And that the stories you find there about Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel and the great flood and the invention of viticulture, Noah finding out that wine intoxicates, and also the story of the Tower of Babel, were the way in which the wise men, the sages in ancient Israel, told the story of the beginning, of how it all began. Israel as a people is really not yet in the picture there. That only begins with Abraham. No, they reflect on what lies before. And here they reflect on the basic issues of all human life. Look, for instance, how in Genesis 11 they reflect with us on one of the most baffling issues of human life, that of language. No, I should rather say of languages. That not all human beings readily understand each other. That we speak different languages. Not only literally, German and English and French and Hebrew, but also metaphorically, that we live in our own worlds with our own languages and often cannot communicate with another human being, even though he or she may speak English or the same language we do. They reflect with us on the issue of language, and they say it has something to do with human arrogance, that the lack of humility, that we don't understand each other. That's a beautiful thought. Or think of the way in which they discuss interhuman relationships, the relationship between man and woman, Genesis 2 and 3. Or the relationship between brother and brother, Genesis 4, Cain and Abel. Or how they discuss with their hearers one of the most baffling stories of old that was alive in the ancient world. Namely, that long ago, a great flood
swept across the whole world and wiped out almost every living creature. The ancient Babylonians told that story. We know it. We have found it. The ancient Hebrews told that story 2, 3, 4 times in the Old Testament, and we have all these versions. Why did they tell that story? Because they liked to set up a museum in which they kept interesting relics of the past? I doubt that very much. The story of the flood, you see, was the story of the ultimate threat to life. For the ancients, especially for the Babylonians, were sometimes devastating floods wiped out part of whole cultures. So the flood story becomes the archetype of the ultimate threat to human life. And they tell that story. They have to. You cannot be a thoughtful Israelite without referring to this and dealing with it. And it is fascinating how all the storytellers of the flood in the Old Testament, there are at least two that very clearly speak to us, and some others who more allude to it, end their story of the great threat to human life with the assurance, no more will God bring the flood. The fire, no more in modern terms. Rather, as long as the earth stands, there shall always be the ordered sequence, the ordered rhythm of the seasons of hot and cold, day and night, winter and summer. So at the end of the flood story, the one version at the end of Genesis chapter 8. Now, I think I have sketched for you somewhat the range and the horizon of the wise men in ancient Israel, of whom, in an aside, the storyteller of the book of Jeremiah tells us, this is what they did, these are the issues upon which they reflected. It is fascinating to observe that in the late Old Testament period, and then still later in the intertestamental period, the 200-300 years before the time of the early rabbis and the time of the early Christians, you have in ancient Israel a wise man, Jesus ben Sira, who in 51 chapters, it's one of the most substantial books found in the Bible, belongs to the Apocrypha, the Roman Catholic Bible, it is part of the Bible, lays out for us the great wealth of wisdom, reflection, and insight that has been gathered in many centuries before, and then makes a very bold affirmation, a very bold equation. He says, all the wisdom of the ancients that he as a wise man has inherited is ultimately centered in, based on, the law of the Lord. And you see how here, wise men and priests, instruction, Torah, law, and advice and counsel begin to merge and come together. And in this merging, they then became the legacy with which the early Christians and the early Jews lived. I'm reminded of the aside in one of the letters of Paul, in the first letter to the Corinthians, in the first chapter, toward the end of the chapter, where Paul can say, more in an aside, he doesn't unfold that too fully, that Christ has been made our righteousness and our wisdom. An interesting thought. And in a way, when you now reread this passage in the New Testament, this wider perspective that I have tried to sketch for you today should arise before the eye of your mind. Now, this brings me to the end of my presentation, and I'm happy now to answer questions you might have. Yes, please.
I was wondering how the priests, especially the priests, but the wise men also come to be what they are. And like, do the priests, do they have a school so that if someone went to one priest and you know, needed a particular thing detailed, you know, if he went to another one, whether they would agree or how they...
Very good question. As far as the priests were concerned, the usual way of learning the priestly trade was by being apprenticed to one's father, because priests came in families. You had to belong to a priestly family, to a Levitic family, to an Aaronite family, to a Sadducite family, and sometimes there were quarrels among them. Never mind. So you became an apprentice to your father, and you simply grew into the job. As far as the wise men is concerned, that was not limited to any family. For instance, we hear also of wise women. Mark that.
Question mark, actually. exclamation mark.
And here it was a much more freewheeling matter. We think, however, and there's some discussion among students of the Old Testament at this point, that the center of wisdom schooling and learning was the royal court. Because royal administration, and of course we had royal administration in ancient Israel and the surrounding countries, needed learned people. For one thing, people who could write. And we know that some of the stories of the ancients, some of the legends of the flood and of Gilgamesh and of the creation among the Babylonians and the Egyptians and also in Syria-Palestine, were the training material, were the readers, were the copying material for the junior scribe. In fact, they have found tablets, slates, school tablets, on which they did their exercises. Sometimes very much grade one quality, I tell you, with lots of mistakes. In other words, you did have schools usually connected with centers of administration, the royal court, sometimes also the temple. And we assume that this was also true in ancient Israel, that you had in Jerusalem and in Samaria, the capitals, and Damascus beyond this, that you had scribal schools where the future wise men were trained. But let me stress, it was not an exclusive matter. Many of us think that next to the royal wisdom and its more administrative bend, you had the more popular homespun type of wisdom that was at home in the councils of the elders, where tribes came together and deliberated about matters, or generally where those old by experience or by age would hand on the insights of the older people. Ben Sira, around 180, 90 before the Common Era, tells us about his yeshiva. And yeshiva is still the modern Hebrew word for an Orthodox seminary. And yeshiva means really something like a budding divinity school. Yeah. And about his seat that he has there, you know, like we speak of chairs in universities, teaching chairs. And we learn a lot about the way in which instruction was carried on. For instance, the young people were brought to school by mother or father, and mother and father would also be sure to bring a lunch along, lest the young man, or occasionally woman, would flag in the course of the day. The teacher was entitled to use the stick at times. We have quite a bit of discussion on that score. There was evidently a lot of repetition, that the teacher would say a proverb or a little discourse and the students would repeat it and then maybe write it. Oh, many more things could be said on that score, but maybe that's enough for an answer.
Thank you.
Yes, please.
I heard somewhere that the Proverbs even include some of the sayings of Confucius.
Now that is a new one on me. But I would have to do a little bit of homework before saying yay or nay. One thing would not be surprising, that because of the international character of wisdom, you would get this. We do have one very clear-cut example. Scholars have always wondered why the little collection that is found in Proverbs 22, 17 to 23, 18 or thereabouts, sort of stands out from the rest. It treats matters that are somewhat different, for instance, etiquette at table when you are invited to a high official. But all right, there it is, and it was interpreted. It also had, at the beginning, a Hebrew word we didn't really know what to make out of it. It looked like, and was usually translated as, the Hebrew word for the day before yesterday, but in context it didn't make any sense. Then, at the end of the last century, there was found in Egypt the sayings of Amen-em-Opet, a sage of Egypt who lived somewhere between the 10th and the 7th century BCE. And the first scholar who read it, who was an Egyptologist but knew his Hebrew Bible, said, "My goodness, this sounds almost exactly like the little collection in Proverbs 22:17, following." So he put the two side by side. It was Eduard Sacher who taught in Berlin, and he says, "Hey, they are parallel versions." Now, they didn't agree in every respect, because in the Hebrew version there were some typically Hebrew additions that fitted it into the Hebrew framework of thought and theology. But it was both laid out, this became clear now, in 30 chapters. And the odd Hebrew word, shilshom, that usually is translated the day before yesterday, really means shaloshim, which means 30. And suddenly the whole thing made sense. And so you have here a beautiful example, most students think, of the Hebrews taking over the best of the wisdom of ancient Egypt and fitting it into their theological framework, very much like Paul would have done, would have said, consider everything, whatever is good, hold on to it. So you see, that would not be surprising, and you can do very interesting studies when you look at other ancient Near Eastern wisdom literature. There is the very well-known Achikah, novel and collection of proverbs, which was much liked in the Eastern churches and was translated into all the major church languages of the East. There is the very well-known Achikah, novel and collection of proverbs, which was much liked in the Eastern churches and was translated into all the major church languages of the East, Armenian, Abyssinian, Ethiopian, and name it. And there you have many sayings that you also encounter in the Book of Proverbs and in Ecclesiasticus, Jesus ben Sira. Now, it's not so much a copying, even though they also copied from each other, but you have to assume that there was an international stock of wise sayings that freely flowed back and forth, and could, because they were concerned with the human being, you see. So they were cosmopolitan, universal by definition. One more question. Yes, please.
What are some of the other wisdom books, like Ecclesiastes?
Right, yes. Now, the first one, and easily the oldest one, at least in many of its parts, is the Book of Proverbs. It is made up of four collections. Many people think that Proverbs 10 through 22 is the oldest collection, possibly Proverbs 25 through 29, a counterpart to it. I think it's probably the oldest, but be that as it may. Then you have certain wisdom psalms, in which wisdom is celebrated through hymns. Now, a late wisdom psalm is Psalm 1, which portrays the scripture scholar as a wise man who meditates and reflects, but already, like Ben Sira, reflects on the law. There are several others of that kind. Psalm 37 comes to mind, Psalm 73 comes to mind, Psalm 119 comes to mind, and several others. Then, of course, the next outstanding wisdom book is the Book of Job, and I've referred to it already. Then you have, in the Old Testament, a wisdom book that has been much discussed, and some people have been baffled why it is included in the Old Testament. I'm speaking of Ecclesiastes, the preacher, you see. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. Well, that is a strange thing to say for someone who stands in the faith of ancient Israel that affirmed that all that is God's creation and as such good. You see the contrast here and the difference. That is commonly counted with the wisdom literature. Among the intertestamental writings, you have two outstanding wisdom writings. Jesus ben Sira is one, which I highly commend to you. It's one of my favorites and one of my special areas of study. In fact, it's my study project for the 3 weeks up here. The other one is the Wisdom of Solomon. Oh. Sorry?
Would you repeat that first title, please?
Ecclesiasticus. Oh, that's a fancy title, isn't it? That comes from the early church. It's not the one that's used in the synagogue. The synagogue speaks of Ben Sira, the son of Sira,
the Christian name that is attested first with the church father Cyprian is Ecclesiasticus. The other one is the Wisdom of Solomon. The Wisdom of Solomon is roughly from the same period, the 2nd century BCE, and originated among Greek-speaking Jews, Hellenistic Jews, in Alexandria. It's a fascinating mixture of Hebrew, Old Testament, religion, and wisdom with early Hellenistic philosophical forms. Recently, good work has been done at the Pontifical Biblical Institute showing how here you have an almost complete and successful synthesis of the two cultures. Of course, we know that a century later, the Jewish Hellenistic philosopher Philo was a beautiful example of that same synthesis, not to mention the early Christian theologian Clement of Alexandria, and then the great saint or heretic, depending on how you look at him, Origen, who comes out of that tradition too. Let me mention two more. In the early Christian, early Jewish period, we have two wisdom writings that I would like to commend highly to you. One is the Q source in the Synoptic Gospels, where Jesus is really a wise man and gives sayings. I do not need to go now into the study of the Synoptic Gospels, but the sayings source that we find in Matthew and Luke, the material that Matthew and Luke have in addition to Mark, a few other problems connected with it, but roughly that's the way we can summarize it, is early Christian wisdom, and Jesus is the wise man. The other wisdom writing from the early Jewish period is one of the tractates of the Mishnah. Now the Mishnah is the authoritative interpretation of the Hebrew scriptures for the early synagogue as far as laws are concerned. It was finalized approximately 200 CE by Yehuda Hanasi, and it contains among its 63 tractates one that is outstanding. It is entitled Sayings of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot. You find it, by the way, in all Jewish prayer books. If you go to a synagogue service, you will find it leafing through it. It is approximately the length of 12, 15 pages in the Bible, and it has sayings of individual rabbis. They are beautiful, and in many respects similar to the sayings of Jesus. One rabbi said, "Do not be like servants who serve their master for the sake of reward. Be like servants who freely serve without wanting to be rewarded." And of course, the Luke and Jesus says the same thing. Okay, here you got a long answer to a short question. Come back tomorrow for the last of the three.
Mm-hmm. Are the first 11 chapters of Genesis and third part of the wise men's writing?
Yes. Most of the chapters. Not chapter 1, not chapter 9, not chapter 5. They come from the priestly tradition. But most others, many of us consider to be from wise historians. Okay. Thank you.